The study of human experience is the study of life in a very important sense. Bring back to your memories all that you have been able to discuss along these lines up to this time and recollect where you stand in this arduous adventure of analysis of human experience. These processes of self-analysis are difficult to remember, inasmuch as analysis and rational judgment with the due consideration of the pros and cons of every act and thought is not the usual way in which we operate in our lives. We are generally driven by instincts, impulses, sentiments and habits of the past, not necessarily guided by reason and considered judgment of values. Inasmuch as we are now here not to be driven by instincts and be pushed by old habits of the social environment and social living, but to consider in a more logical form the causative factors operating behind our experiences in all the aspects of the dimension which they occupy in the scheme of things. We have come to the point of confronting the universe before us as a large body of experience, which has ever managed to place itself in the position of an object. And even just now at this very moment when we are speaking and listening to, it remains an object of our consciousness. People around us are our objects of sensory perception and mental cognition. Things around us are of a similar nature. The world as a whole refuses to be recognized in any other manner as a content of our awareness and object of our experience. This is a hard task that is before us, to resolve this mystery of our relationship to things. We cannot understand the correct relationship that obtains even between ourselves and our own near neighbor. How is this neighbor related to us? Who is my neighbor? Was a question put to Jesus Christ by an inquisitive person. How do you know what sort of relation is there between you and the next man? We are not in a position to easily probe into this difficulty. That there is some sort of a connection of one thing with another goes without saying. No one will gainsay this fact that there is relationship among people, a sort of cause and effect relation among all things. But what do you mean by relation? I have already tried to touch upon the intriguing character of the very concept of relation, and we cannot understand what it actually means, where it stands, does it belong to the subject or to the object, or is it independent of both? We found that cannot belong to the subject, cannot belong to the object, and it cannot also stand independently. Thus the world is a world of relativity, inscrutability, indeterminability, and unintelligibility. Nothing can be understood to the core, inasmuch as relation stands as a concept which cannot be explained and cannot be understood. How am I related to you and you are related to me? Nobody knows. Again, there is a psychological habit which takes for granted that there is such a thing called relation, whatever that relation be. This difficulty is the difficulty of all life, any kind of life, anywhere. It boils down to other difficulties of our inability to understand what we ourselves are and what anything is, what the world is, what creation is, what life itself means. Life stands before us as a mystery. Because the mystery is hidden within our own selves as an incapacity to understand anything whatsoever within or without. All this difficulty arises because our probing is shallow. It is not an in-depth analysis. The senses are so powerful, our social instincts are so rapacious in their demands, our hunger for name and fame, authority, power and wealth is so intensive that these pressures will not permit the mind to go deep into its own self. It requires a Herculean energy on the part of the seeker of truth to resist the onslaught of these cyclones of sensory movements. No one can stand them. When a tornado blows, we too will be blown out together with its movement. But by abhyasa and vairagya, as the Bhagavad Gita and Patanjali puts it, by persistent tenacious practice and an attempt to cut off the internal connection of the senses with the so-called externality of things, we can, with intense hardship no doubt, go deep into ourselves. The going deep into ourselves is also at the same time a going deep into anything in the world. To know yourself is to know all people, all things, the whole world. Just as researchers in biology have demonstrated that the whole man can be seen in one cell of his body. The human body is a macrocosm to the cell, which is the microscopic mini representation of the human organism. In one drop of blood, we are told that the whole history of man can be read, right from his birth to death. And it is not for nothing that our scriptures have told us that The whole history of man is written when he is in the womb of the mother. The length of life for which he is to live, the experiences through which he has to pass, and the relationships in society which are to decide his experiences. These are written in invisible characters by the mystery of the cosmos even before the child comes out of the womb. Because every child is a child of the universe. It is not born to one person, one individual called the father, another called the mother. Every event is a cosmic event. Every baby is the child of the whole cosmos. It belongs to the universe. Everyone belongs to the universe. Everything, myself, yourself, all people. Neither you belong to me nor I belong to you. Nobody possesses anything here. One cannot be the object of possession and enjoyment by another. Such a thing cannot obtain in this world where everything belongs to one single centrality of operation, the government of the cosmos. Whereas we cannot conceive of a greater socialistic form of administration than the way in which the universe operates, where each one is for everyone and everyone for each. This is an empirical difficulty and also a philosophical problem. Where everything is hanging on everything else, thinking is not possible. And yoga drives you to this point where thinking is not possible. It is thinking that is your doom. Thinking in terms of perception, doubt, memory, sleep, and other things which are the psychic operations in man. The great aphorism of Patanjali puts it plainly before us that every psychic activity is a hindrance to the impulse to the practice of yoga. Yoga is not a psychic operation, a mental activity. It is not thinking. It is a tendency to being in a larger dimension. When we enter into the field of yoga, we expand the ambit of our existence. We do not merely start thinking something as an object outside us. We think being as such in the various degrees of its expression. We are individuals, and in that sense we are also a sort of being. I am. This consciousness of I amness is an affirmation of the being of the isolated individuality. The rise of the yoga consciousness is from this level of being to the next higher state of being, where it includes the environment of the individual's perception and experience. Not in the sense of a contact with the environment outside, as it happens in ordinary sense perception, but in an inclusion of this atmosphere in the ambit of one's experience. This is called yoga samadhi, samyama, the art of uniting one's being with the being of that which appears tentatively as an atmosphere around oneself. The environment around us is a being in itself, it exists. This existence of the environment around us is inseparable from the being of our own selves as we appear to us. Unfortunately, this environment stands outside us, so we struggle with the environment. We are in conflict with the environment, the atmosphere. We struggle to exist because of the fear of the unknown motives behind the way in which environment operates. This fear vanishes when the environment becomes a part of our existence. Yoga is the art of union with every content of consciousness. That which the consciousness apprehends as an existent something is its content, that may be called its environment also. When I am conscious that I am placed in an environment of people around me, of air blowing, sun shining, and earth under me, all these ideas that occur to me are ideas of an environment which is physical, social, political, and every blessed thing. This complicated environment of the perceiving consciousness, which stands outside in space and time as an object thereof, has to get absorbed into the being of the perceiving consciousness in deep meditation. This is a difficult art. Meditation is a difficult job because the mind insists on affirming that the environment is outside, people are external, things are unconnected. The obsession that things around us are unconnected to us will not leave us till the end of our life. The child born of our egoism, which affirms the isolatedness of our being. Ego is hard like flint. It will not melt even by the application of the heat of meditation. Yet, it has to be affected. A day has to come when we shall have to achieve this purpose. All our desire, all our ambition, all our conflict, all our love and all our hatred in life is a multiformed expression of our attempt to seek a union and harmony with the environment around us. But we bungle in this attempt. We fumble and fall and get defeated and receive a kick in our attempt to establish this union between ourselves and the environment around us. Thus we feel frustrated and come back. But nevertheless, our activities in life are a blind groping in the darkness of ignorance, in the direction of a communion that we wish to establish with the universe outside, which we never achieve. Because of the difficulty in controlling the senses, who insist on saying again and again, that the environment is outside you, you can never have any union with them. But our desire is nothing but a desire for union with things. When you love an object, you wish to enter into that object and absorb that object into yourself as a part of yourself. You wish to get absorbed into that object as a part of that object. And all fulfillment of affection and love is the fulfillment of union with the object of affection. And where there is hatred, animosity and conflict, it is only the negative side of this affection which operates like the obverse of the same coin of the human attempt to encounter the world, its environment. This is the outcome of our study of the internal relation that obtains between us and the world outside. We have to some extent conducted an analysis of our own self. Then we studied in a measure the process of knowledge, what we call the epistemological predicament. We encountered the universe. I tried to explain to you some detail as to the internal structure of the cosmos in its various planes of expression. Now we are coming to a crucial point in our spiritual adventure, namely the character of the ultimate reality of the universe, which is a more difficult problem for us to understand and encounter and analyze than anything that we have been discussing up to this time. What is truth finally? What exists finally, ultimately? Everything passes, everything is transient, everything moves, everybody born also dies. We have never seen truth in this world. That which perishes demonstrates its unreality. I am not true. I go. That which goes with a proclamation of the inadequacy of its own being. Everything moves, everything is a flow of energy, of force. You cannot touch the same water in a flowing river the next moment, nor can you touch the same fire in a moving flame. Perhaps you may not be able to touch the same object the next moment. It transforms itself in an impulse of movement which carries it onward, forward, towards a destination which no one knows. Such being the case of things in this world, such being the character of the whole world as it were, which perishes every moment like a bubble that bursts, what can be truth? We live in a world of untruths, transitory to the core, mortality gripping everything relentlessly. Martyloka is this. Everything dies. Why one dies, no one knows. Why should one be reborn, no one knows. What is birth? What is death? What is transition? What is all this drama of the universe? What is anything at all? It is a question which will point to the possibility of our solving this mystery of the ultimate reality of the universe. If nothing was possible, everything is transitory, no question will arise, because the question also will be transitory. There is something which speaks within us in the language of eternity, not merely in the language of transitoriness. The consciousness of the transitoriness of things is an indication of the presence of a non-transitory eternity. This is a subtle voice that speaks within us, but it gets stifled, smothered by the mud that is thrown over it and the dust that is kicked up by the activity of the senses, which blinds our eyes and we see not what is hidden behind this profundity within our own selves. The art of yoga is the procedure which the deepest in man adopts in the solution of the mystery of life. I have been mentioning on different occasions that yoga is not what you actually do as a human being, it is an art of being. We will not be able to make out any sense out of this mystery of the art of being. What does it mean after all? What do you mean by being? A being is that which has to be distinguished from becoming by a subtle distinction that has to be drawn between them. The world that we see, that we are experiencing before us, this body in which we are caught up, this visible life is becoming because it is a movement. It becomes, it never is. We also become every moment of time. We have been growing and growing right from our babyhood, and we are growing and decaying, moving, undergoing transformation. Even our human individuality is a becoming. There is no being in ourselves. But the fact that we are able to know that we are involved in becoming is an answer to the question as to what is behind becoming. All becoming, all movement, all evolution is an impulse to being. So that becoming is the response of the universe to the call of that which is pure being. That which you call eternal, that which you consider the infinite, that which is beyond the transitoriness of perception, space and time, that summons all becoming towards itself. As the periphery of a circle may be summoned by the center thereof, we are pulled in spite of ourselves. We run fast in a direction of which we have no consciousness. All the religions of the world, all the philosophies have racked their brains, scratched their heads in trying to know what this call is that keeps a man restless from moment to moment. Why should we be restless if we are totally involved in becoming? Because we die every moment of time, and in this perpetual process of dying, there is no time for us to get restless. There cannot be any such thing called joy and sorrow in a world of total transitoriness. This stands to logic. But there seems to be a secret hidden behind the transitoriness and the dying process of things. That secret keeps us ever restless. the feeling of joy and sorrow, and the anxiety and the insecurity and the difficulties that we experience in our lives cannot be explained if everything is purely passing. Because a thing that passes cannot have an experience that it passes. Then there cannot be any experience at all. No one can know anything. Even the thing that tries to know a thing cannot know that it is doing so. It will be a fool's paradise to the core, but it does not appear to be such. Even in the contradictions of life, there is an impulse from within us to resolve these contradictions. Otherwise, why should there be conferences, organizations, efforts of any kind whatsoever? Why should man do anything at all and think anything at all? If everything is passing, dying, and nothing exists finally, here is an indirect answer arising from within our own selves to the question of life as a whole. We are the answers to our own questions, not the books, not the scriptures, not even the gurus of the world can help us finally. We have to stand our own legs. Finally, we will find the Guru is within us, God is within us, secret is within us, immortality is within us, and that which we struggle for is being carried by us every moment from place to place. The treasure is within us. But this withinness of ours is again a mystery that eludes our understanding. We are empirically brainwashed. Empirical ridden senses tell us that the withinness of experience is nothing but the withinness of the body. That which is inside the body is within, that which is outside the body is without. The existence of the body is the reason behind our entertaining notions of inside and outside. If the body were not, there would be no such idea. But can we think as pure consciousness, which we seem to be? A conclusion we arrive at by self-analysis itself. The three states of waking, dream and sleep, when they are analyzed thoroughly, threadbare, reveal to us that we do exist under conditions bereft of the awareness of even the body and the mind. For instance, in deep sleep, there is a subtle suggestion in the state of deep sleep that we do exist independent of body encasement and mental restrictions. In what condition do we exist in deep sleep? Except as a bare minimum of the awareness that we bear, anything more, nothing less. We existed, we were, we are, I am, nothing more can be said about the condition in which we persisted at the back of the condition we call sleep. This bare, featureless transparency of consciousness seems to be our essential nature, and consciousness is an indivisible something. No one can cut consciousness into pieces. It cannot be divided into parts. No one can imagine a division within consciousness. You cannot divide yourself into two parts, or any number of parts. The very attempt at imagining a division in consciousness asserts the indivisibility of consciousness. Because the consciousness of there being a gap between two parts of consciousness is again filled by consciousness itself. Therefore, a conception of the division of consciousness is impossible. there is no dividedness in the being of consciousness. Consciousness is being, being is consciousness. Satta eva bodha, bodha eva cha satta, says Acharya Shankara in a famous passage in his commentary on the Brahma Sutras. Being is consciousness, consciousness is being. The awareness that I am is also the awareness that I exist. I amness is nothing but existence affirming itself as being conscious of itself. We cannot separate being from consciousness, consciousness from being. When I feel that I am, it is a summing up of the blend of consciousness and the being thereof, and vice versa. So, the minimum of our being is the barest residuum of consciousness. We are not bodies, men, women, children, nothing of the kind. This is the root from which we start the practice of yoga, the operation of consciousness, not of the senses and the psychic operations, all which have to be restrained by a nirodha. As the yoga puts it, chitta vritti nirodha. The restraint of the senses and the mind is the restraint of those conditioning factors which compel us to feel that we are always bodies, individuals, human beings. We have to melt down, as it were, in a way, these impulsions to the feeling that we are pinpointed to one place through a body and segregated from others. But this suggestion and hint at the nature of the ultimate reality as pure consciousness and indivisible being leaves us in a peculiar difficulty which sometimes overwhelms us with an impossibility to move onward. The reality of the world persists even here at the point of our coming to a final conclusion that the final reality of things should be being consciousness, sat-chit. The winds of life blow so hard upon us that they will not easily leave us to ourselves. Again and again you have to persist in this meditation. Upon the conclusion you have very wisely arrived at, through this analysis of being consciousness as the final reality of things, notwithstanding the fact that you are tossed hither and thither by the waves of empirical existence. As a person caught up in the waves of the ocean, sinking down this moment and rising up on the surface another moment, only to sink down again. So we in this ocean of life go within and come up to the surface only to see the world again with our eyes. Yet, we should develop within ourselves a hardihood and a toughness of conscious behavior by which we shall stand firmly on ourselves and apply the whole of our will to a dedicatedness of whatever we are in our entirety for this great purpose of bringing to the level of our conscious experience what has remained only as a suggestion at the barest minimum of our being. Now we have only logically come to a conclusion that the whole universe seems to have at its core the reality of being, consciousness, existence, knowledge, satta and chit. But logical assertion should become part of feeling and experience. Mere intellectual analysis would not suffice in a world where instincts are strong. You know very well how logically instinct and scientifically you behave in a court of law or an office in which you are working. But we are poor, instinct-ridden people in our own families, in our little circles of private relationship. The public life of ours is different from our private life. You know very well, we are not within us what we are outwardly in external relationship. This is a proof of the inability of logical conclusions to guide our life wholly because of the strength of emotions and feelings and instincts and sentiments which have become part of our living, which have to get blended with logical understanding. All the logic of the reason should go hand in hand with the deepest feelings within us. We should not feel something and understand another thing. Otherwise, we would be like people being convinced against their own will, who would hold the same opinion still, as the poet puts it. A person who is convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. He doesn't change. So all the teachings go over our heads mostly. Because teachings are on the surface of our life. They remain as communications in the empirical realm of our sensory existence. But there is a trans-empirical being in us, which is subliminal and not merely what we see with our senses. This has to be brought to the surface of consciousness. In a way, we are conducting a super psychoanalytical inquiry where we bring up to the surface of consciousness not merely what is subconscious and unconscious, but what is spiritual. The Atman, the Self, is brought to the surface of conscious experience so that that indivisibility of experience which remained as a suggestion only in that state of deep sleep becomes a direct experience in our waking consciousness, so that when we are conscious, we are not conscious that there is a divided world of isolated individuals, but we become conscious of the indivisible connectedness of our being with the whole cosmos. And yoga is a movement towards this larger interrelatedness of our being, so that when we think in yoga, we think in a way as the whole cosmos thinks. Hari Om Tat Sat.